Kamala Harris is expected to be meeting with Netanyahu, and what you'd like to see happen here.
You know, it's repugnant to me to be hearing that a war criminal, a person who has flattened Gaza, who said that he was going to flatten Gaza, who's issued orders to kill more than 40,000, upwards of 190,000 Palestinians. We still don't know the numbers. Who has made life in Gaza unlivable, who's using Palestinians as human pinballs, telling them to move from one area to the next, who's presiding over a genocide, and unabashedly so. It's going to be shocking to see the number of applause and rounds of applause and the standing ovations that this man is going to be receiving. It very much signals exactly where the United States is, which is complicit in this genocide. And Palestinians know this. If anything, that he should have not had received an invitation. He should simply be getting a warrant for his arrest, not be receiving applause and accolades in Congress.
Diana Bhutu, I want to thank you so much for being with us. Palestinian human rights attorney joining us from Brussels, Belgium. That does it for our show. Democracy Now! Is currently accepting applications for a director of development to lead our fundraising team. You can learn more and apply at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Burke, Dean Augusto, Sharif Abdelkadous, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Tarasena, Tammy Warrenoff, Tarina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamari Astugio, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Hani Masood, and Hannah Elias. Our executive director is Julie Crosby. Special thanks to Becca Staley, John Randolph, Paul Powell, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Nogueira, Hugh Grant, Dennis Moynihan, David Prude, Dennis McCormick. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
This is Norman Solomon saying that you're listening to non-commercial, listener-sponsored, volunteer-driven community radio, KBOO, Portland, 90.7 FM.
I down all in the ground, I'd root that mountain down, and I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Tune in to KBOO Monday mornings at 9 for the Old Mole Variety Hour, your source for radically democratic news, views, reviews, and interviews. Stories of ordinary and extraordinary people working to root down the oppressive institutions of capitalism. That's the Old Mole Variety Hour, Monday mornings at 9.
This morning, we will not be broadcasting more talk radio with Cecil Prescott. He will be back next week. Please enjoy the next show on the schedule. And thank you for listening to KBOO, Portland.
Two, three, four.
Y'all ready for this?
Ladies and gentlemen.
Never been done before talking about a subject.
To bring you to the light.
Farewell to you, people.
David D. Hard Knock Radio hanging out with you this afternoon. We've been wanting to catch up with this brother for a minute, but so much that has been going on, from Project 2025 to calls for Joe Biden to step down to the attempted assassination of former President Trump to the start of the Republican National Convention. And that's just the tip of the iceberg. Joining us out of Jackson, Mississippi is Kalyan Kuno from Cooperation Jackson. Kali, so much to talk about, but I know that you were away for a while and you got to travel overseas. And I want to just start off with how things are playing out in other lands. What's the perception? What's being talked about? What is showing up? And I'll just share that I was out the country for about 2 or 3 weeks. For the most part, it was business as usual for many people. What was going on here was not necessarily being bantered about. I was hearing more about what was going on in Europe, France, and other places than I was with the U.S. And interestingly enough, if there was anything that was making it, were narratives about crime going on in the U.S. I saw stories about New York. I saw stories of Chicago. I saw stories coming out of Oakland. You know, when I meet people and you say you're from Oakland, it's like, oh, yeah, I read about you guys. You guys have, you know, a burger place clothing down, you know, and stuff like that. more than it was some of the good things that we're doing, or even the entertainers and people that come out. So I say that one of the things that I personally see being exported around the world are narratives about crime and a black face being accompanied with it, which is a very powerful narrative. I don't know how that plays out, you know, moving into the elections, but it's definitely something that is being pushed, you know, and not by accident, by design. But you were away, and you know, and probably traveling much more politically astute circles. So how have you seen things?
Well, I was in Greece doing some work there and working with some comrades there. They were deeply studying what was going on and what is going on in the United States, but also paying very close attention to what's going on in their own backyard. And so, you know, the day I arrived was the day that they did the first round of voting in France.
Yeah.
You know, and the National Front was clearly in the lead. And so they were very concerned about, you know, having an outright fascist organization controlling France, which they kind of acknowledges is in many respects the heartland of Europe. You know, at least when it comes to kind of political ideas, political and culture to a degree, you know, at least over the past several centuries. And with the overall drift towards the right that is taking place within Europe, you know, they were very, very concerned and were of the view that the United States was in disarray and was also going to be controlled by a fascist fairly soon. So when I first got there, there was a lot of angst and a lot of anxiety about where things were going and where they were headed. Folks were very, you know, throughout the entire week that I was there, week and some change, you know, they were working the phones frantically to comrades that they knew in France in particular, you know, to get them to go out and vote, because there was a call from many of the social movements in France to boycott the vote. And so they were calling on folks, hey, we understand the sentiment, but don't do that, go vote. So I was kind of watching them, you know, do that, you know, by text and by social media and by direct calls, you know, all throughout the week as we were going through doing work about, you know, cooperatives and the solidarity economy and you know, checking out where things stood with their solidarity economy kind of initiatives, basically since the post-Syriza era, right? And some of the things that they're trying to put back. But there was a deep concern, you know, as you mentioned, while I was there, that the whole debate about whether Biden should drop out of the race was at a fever pitch. You know, and just the concerns about Project 2025, you know, that is being studied, you know, very voraciously in Europe, at least in the circles that I was in. You know, and they were very much in tune to how much Viktor Orban and was it the Fidesz party, his party in Hungary, had shaped Project 2025, or at least was an influence of it. So they were providing me with some details and to fill in the picture. You know, that's a bit incomplete, being on the other side of the Great Pond, as they say. But there was a, you know, it was a different ball game. You know, and you know, folks got to keep in mind, you know, Greece has a long history of being subject, you know, to U.S. imperialism. And so, you know, the Greek left in particular studies what's happening in the United States very closely, because what happens in the United States shapes so much of what's going to happen in terms of policy and program coming out of the United States and NATO to impact their future. So there was a lot of following of what was going on.
Right. And Greece has its own right wing challenges, you know. I remember with the Golden Dawn, anti-black political party and structure that had formatted, and it wasn't too long ago that black folks were being killed, you know, over there. You know, so Greece is a very interesting place, but the move rightward is something that, you know, has global implications, whether it's been in Argentina, you know, what's been happening in India, and as you mentioned, France, with a big harbinger, so to speak, that, you know, caused concern. But at the end, if I'm correct, France has ranked choice voting. Is it, so they have several rounds of voting. So it's, you know, things start off and then they kind of go through the different things.
Yeah, they have a process which is very similar to ranked choice voting, which is why in the end, you know, they wind up electing a new coalition of left forces.
Right.
You know, because they can shape it as different candidates can drop out, so there was only, you know, one or two people in a particular race to give, you know, who they felt more on the left or from the center, from Macron's party, a better chance to beat, you know, the candidate from Le Pen's party. And that somewhat worked out for him, you know, for those who were trying to defeat the fascists and kind of protect the center, basically, you know, French democracy. That worked out, at least temporarily. Now, I would caution folks who kind of look at that as a victory to a degree, because if you take Le Pen's party and you take the more traditional kind of conservative party, they actually still have the majority. Now, those two forces typically just don't work with each other, but that doesn't mean that they won't work with each other under these new circumstances. And it's not, you know, automatically clear that Macron won't work with them at the end of the day. You know, one of the things I heard from a few comrades in France was, you know, that one of the first things that Macron was seen doing was having dinner with many of the conservative party leaders and trying to strike a deal with them. And if, you know, it's been, what, like a week and a half since that's gone down, and they still don't have a prime minister, you know, which somebody who should come from the left. So, you know, and Macron is a creature of the right. I want folks to understand that. He's not a fascist, but he is a creature of the neoliberal right. And he claims to try to represent the center, which, you know, in this, given the balance of where things are at ideologically and politically, he probably does represent the center in France right now. But it's a center that leans very heavily towards the right. And, you know, it's very clear that the left coalition has a lot of things to work out, and it may split, you know, and it's very clear that Macron, in many respects, and his party are trying to split the left. And Parcel Mélenchon, who's probably the most prominent figure on the left in France, doesn't assume the prime minister seat, and that they can give it to somebody else. You know, because he has a different take on Ukraine. He has a far different take. Him and his forces have a far different take on Palestine. They aim to recognize Palestine, have France recognize Palestine. They aim to adhere to the ICC ruling, which means that if Netanyahu and many others came to France, that they would be arrested and subjected to the court. You know, and from what I'm hearing, at least from a lot of the comrades I know in France on the ground, and I'll be talking to them again, hopefully doing some interviews with them in the next couple of days. You know, they rallied to Mélenchon because he understands the primacy of you know, the black and Arab vote on use in what we would call the hood. And that they rallied to that particular his banner in this particular case, because it's fundamentally one of the only parties that both offers something to black and Arab peoples, but also has a core black and Arab constituency already. So, you know, that one's going to be interesting to watch. And in all the conversations I've been having with folks, you know, the French election is only a two-year term at this particular point in time, just given the nature. And what they are preparing for, and what I was warning, said all the signs to me point to y'all stalled the fascists from getting in power, but y'all didn't defeat them. And the way that they are both consolidated and organized, and how well-financed they are in France, as they are in the United States, that they will probably assume control in France in 2 years if there's not some fundamental shift in the organizing and coalition building that happens amongst working class and oppressed communities in France. So they are in some trouble, like we are in some trouble, basically.
Let me ask you a question, Kali. There are several things that come to mind, and we just had Medea Benjamin on, and one of the things that she talked about was strategically people are going to have to engage parts of this system and push back. And we were talking about AIPAC among things, and she was explaining that being in D.C., that, you know, these folks are relentless. They call up Congress. They show up at their meetings, go to their offices, do these things. And there's a lot of folks that, you know, wring their hands around the genocide that's happening and things that are going on. But at the same time, they're pretty clear, like they're not going to engage the system any form of fashion. And she felt like that's kind of a mistake. She said, you know, we're going to have to do that, even as you feel like you need to pull down the system and move it in another direction. You can't cede that ground. What stood out to me was you telling me about your friends who were calling up and saying, hey man, you guys gotta make these votes. You got to engage it. We still have a very sizable population of people here in the States, even in the face of Project 2025, even in the face of the draconian rhetoric that is coming out, which I think is definitely going to be played out in law. If the Supreme Court in the recent dismissal of charges levied against Trump with a judicial appointee doesn't spell out, you know, what is intended, I don't know what will. But people have been like, I'm not going to be bothered with this. There's no way, and you know, and I understand it, but if folks do not have structures in place and are fully prepared, as you pointed out, to withstand the totalitarian storm that will be here with folks, you know, clearly intending to put things into position so that they last several decades at the very least, what should folks be doing at this point that hold the position that says, I'm not engaging the system?
Well, if we're not doing any organizing, you know, we are fundamentally setting ourselves up to fail.
But what does organizing look like? Because I think people feel that their organizing is to take a stand and not engage the system. What, you know, when we talked about it...
Can you feed yourself?
Yeah.
You know, do you have enough control over the resources, you know, the water, the electricity, things of that nature, to take care of yourself, your family, your community? You know, do you have enough access to medical care and adequate medical treatment? Do you have enough access to the medicines that you will need, either in the form of herbs or in the form of, you know, the more processed synthetic medicines that so many of us are dependent upon? You know, this may sound weird coming from me and folks who know me, but look, we are all in various ways in the United States, at the very least, integrated into the system in one form or another. You know, the dynamics of how strong the state is and how deep capitalism penetrates all of our lives, we are involved in it. Now, if you want to consider it a charade, and in many respects it is a charade of bourgeois electoral politics and not want to engage in that. Okay, that's one thing. But recognize that, you know, what happens there has an impact on your life. And you have to set up things with collectives that if you don't want to engage with, that will at least fortify you and protect you from some of the most, you know, dangerous and egregious aspects of what the state will do on behalf of capital to further make you dependent upon the system and the market dynamics that structure all of our lives. So there's no way, to a certain extent, you completely can disengage from it. And so, you know, in a period like this, where, you know, it's either, you know, support genocide abroad, you know, in the form of supporting Joe Biden, or, you know, supporting the possibility, the highly probable possibility of those genocidal practices coming more acute and more aggressive, aka at home inside the United States empire. You know, these are the fundamental choices that we have. And if you want to abstain from supporting either one of those, I'm not particularly mad at you, but that does not mean you need to kind of retreat into some small isolated cave or you know, disengage from your neighbors in the broader community, because we are going to need you to be able to if we believe that this society and all trends are that is headed towards some major strife, bloodshed, if not civil war. You know, we're going to need folks with both clarity, skill, and purpose to help defend all of us who want to see a different world, and are willing to organize, struggle, and fight to make that happen. But you know, like the issue is to a certain degree, you know, the kind of abstain position that many of us have is not matched with a deeper commitment towards organizing. And that is a big piece that we have to overcome. Now, you know, the I don't do blanket condemnation, because, you know, what I said is easier said than done.
Right.
Right. Because many people are on the grind and have to work two or three jobs. So, you know, getting up and talking to your neighbors or your friends and comrades when you can barely make ends meet in the way that our economy is structured, that's more than a notion. But we're going to have to dig deep, I think, to get out of our shells, get out of our comfort zones in this next period to really engage with each other. Because the right is an organized force that has clear designs on how it is going to restructure and reshape society when they take the full reins of power. And if we leave it completely up to them, trust me, we're going back to the 16th century if they are able to run shop in the way that they plan on running shop, meaning, you know, black and brown people would be, you know, probably working some field or some factory somewhere. Women would be in the house and mandated to producing as many babies as possible, particularly the white women, given the political ideology and orientation. They'd probably be, you know, sterilizing as many, you know, black women as they did with black women in the South and Puerto Rico and other places, given the utter racist nature of what their vision prescribes and is dictating that they actually execute in a very systemic fashion with initiatives like Project 2025. So I don't think, you know, like if at this late date, trying to encourage folks to vote, you know, I'm not mad at folks who do that, but I'm much more important on we lack a program of what's going to happen after the Republicans take the reins, after, you know, Donald Trump is elected. What are we going to do? You know, and we need to start having a deeper conversation about that. And I see that sorely lacking amongst progressive and left circles, unfortunately.
Well, a few things, Kali and Kunu, that come to mind. You know, we've been having you on this show, and you've been on several other shows throughout our network, at least for the past 8 to 9 years. You and others have been very consistent and very emphatic in the conversation about we have to prepare. You use the word organize, but we have to prepare, and you have to make sure that you have in place basic things that will allow you to survive a storm. And in spite of all these conversations, many people have not taken even the first step to do that. People can speak a good game, but they have not taken those fundamental steps. And I see the work that you and so many others at Cooperation Jackson does. And, you know, to me, that's like the tip of the iceberg. And at the same time, it's awe-inspiring. It's like, man, y'all do a lot of stuff down there. But people haven't even moved an iota in that direction, even if it's just to support you all. You know, make sure that, you know, like, how can I invest and make sure whatever y'all are doing can be scaled up? The other thing that comes to mind, there are people that would wring their hands and wag their fingers and tell you to vote. And they, too, have not really taken a step to do the least bit organizing. I often tell people in my conversations with them that will say, well, this is a mistake if you go third party and everybody needs to vote. And it's like voting ain't just going to do it. You're going to have to be doing the phone banking. You got radical friends that were in another country that were literally phone banking. And you got folks that are sitting right here in a nice blue state where, you know, it's likely that a candidate like Trump will lose by 4 million, but they won't put skin in the game and maybe make calls and do phone banking and do the sacrifice of work slash organizing in key battleground states where the fight is really going to be taken. And shame on them for not doing that. And at this point in time, let me just say this, because since that is the field that they're standing on, right, and that is the game that they insist that people play, then they too have a similar responsibility to be organized and organized at least around that particular activity. And if they haven't done that, I'm talking about folks that would kind of frown on folks who don't want to engage electoral politics and they wave that banner, but they're not doing anything other than maybe just showing up on you know, a Tuesday and not doing the work that I see is being done meticulously and very fervently by the right. And I'll say one last thing to this. In looking at Project 2025 and the shows that we've done, they've been very pointed at looking at lifestyles of various groups that they want to tackle and oppress. And they literally have designed laws just for them. So if you're a movement person, well, we will criminalize you. We will now charge basic things into felonies. You know, we got a taste of that, of what's going on with encampments on the universities. You know, we start to do these things, just like with the tax laws. They looked at blue states like California and said, hey, look, everybody else can write off in their taxes the cost of a house. But you guys in Cali, where the average price of a house is a mil, you only get to write off half of that, if that. You know, so those type of laws are almost designed to cripple and keep us having to spin our wheels on basic stuff, you know, with what they're trying to implement. It's designed to go after people very specifically who they see as a threat and lock them up, you know, physically, economically, and literally.
Well, look, let me put it this way, Davey. You know, American exceptionalism is a real thing. And what do I mean by that? You know, we have, and this one I'm saying all of us in your listening audience to a degree, and I include myself in that in many respects. We have some blind spots in believing that this system is so strong that, you know, certain elements of it are going to hold, you know, like the law and order components, you know, the market components, that they will somehow hold regardless of kind of who's in charge, who's at the helm, you know, in the executive seat or in the Congress. You know, and given the imperial nature and the largesse that has come with U.S. Society, you know, basically since World War II, you know, that kind of the material comforts that exist here reinforce that in many respects.
Mm-hmm.
And that creates its own kind of inertia, right? That you see of, like, you know, in some circles, deep levels of concern, that, you know, an anxiety amongst, like, the Democrats, which is, you know, we gotta save democracy. You know, democracy's on the line, and that's mirrored by certain forces on the left, which are, you know, saying that, hey, you know, we see the fascists coming, we need four more years. But, you know, where it falls short and where it relies, where I'm saying that exceptionalism comes into play, is that neither one of them, for the most part, have a plan on, okay, well, if the fascists win, or when they win, what are we going to do? What have we set up? You know, and in that regard, you know, if we're being real, we the folks who are kind of lambasting folks who don't vote, which in two, you know, most years, election cycles, that actually the majority of people in the United States actually don't vote.
Right.
You know, so folks lambasting them when we don't even have a program that would help us address the fears that are being raised. You know, that's a very dangerous game that we are playing. And unfortunately, speaking of what you're saying, you know, we see it in Jackson quite a bit, you know, because we're trying to do our farming and, you know, building up the material capacity with the community production so that we can kind of produce the tools and things that we need. You know, and outside some forces in the you know, the Black radical community, Black nationalist community, you know, in Jackson, most folks even there still believe that, you know, well, Trump is going to, you know, may get elected, and it may be hard, but I'll still be able to get food from the grocery store. I'll still be able to go get, you know, medical care. I'll still be able to, you know, go to work. Well, none of that is guaranteed.
Well, right? if you follow the analysis,
you know, none of that is guaranteed.
Right, and so, that's, you know, a very dangerous. A very dangerous way of thinking. You know, it's almost like a romanticizing. You know, and I see people say this all the time. Well, you know, we've survived slavery. We survived this. We survived. No. Your parents and grandparents survived that. And they made sacrifices so that life would be a little bit easier. But in those sacrifices, they didn't anticipate having to train you to do the things that they were able to do, hunt fish, you know, and survive off the land and all these things that you know, we brag and take credit for, which
but
I
we
think,
actually are not in a position to execute.
Right,
even now in the South now, we're not. Right. A lot of people live in cities. They don't live in rural areas.
Right.
And you got access to go hunt possum and raccoon and fish and do all that kind of stuff.
So that's a mistake. But one of the things that one of the things that you're saying is paramount is that people got to organize. And I think you tell me how you see it. Organizing starts with building community. It starts with having that conversation with your neighbor. And part of American exceptionalism is individuality. That's core to that. Like, I'm rough and rugged and I can do it on my own. And even if you are just, you know, I'm going to use it as the example, electorally going to engage, at least take the steps to start talking to people outside of your comfort zone so you could start building community, because the residual benefit of that is at least I now know some people that I didn't know before. And if push comes to shove, I can remember I had a conversation with an actual farmer you know, on the phone, maybe phone banking. I actually ran into doctors that ran into free clinics, and I know that there are some resources that are available versus being an individual participant at a time when community and building community will be paramount in order to survive. And from the conversations that we have and looking at Project 2025, it is very surgically trying to dismantle and make sure that communities never get built, you know, by literally going back to Black law, you know, the Black codes that they had, you know, I mean, they don't have it as plain as that, you know, three people standing in a corner who ain't working are vagrants and now subject to being arrested. But they're damn near close, you know, because just organizing is criminalized now. I don't think that is fully realized by folks, and it may not be fully realized because a lot of people don't organize. So when you say it to them, it's kind of like, yeah, you know, but I'm going to get together. And it's like, no, do you understand that that will be against the law? You know, it's like you don't really understand the importance of that, and how much of a almost like a privilege, because in many places you can organize, you know, in dictatorial countries all around the world. I mean, you know, pick a country where it is like that, and you could see that folks are like, we will kill the opposition, we will jail the opposition, and we will punish, you know, those who support the opposition. That happens in many places around the world, and I don't know if there's a full grasp and understanding.
It doesn't. Most people don't have that, and that's where that American exceptionalism that's why I brought that up and invoked that, right? Because there's this notion that none of that can happen here, right? That America is the United States is somehow immune to the terror that it is basically, you know, wrought on the rest of the world for the last 100-something years, right? And supported and installed most of the dictatorships that we are talking about. But somehow, you know, the Constitution has some kind of magic that keeps, you know, that type of dictatorship from being installed and in play here. Folks are going about to, you know, let me make it clear what I think is going to happen. If you've heard me say this, and I'll say it again. You know, I've been saying, as you know, David, that Trump is going to win these elections. I was saying that before the debacle of the debate that Biden did with him, that had, you know, the disarray and utter disarray. And I've been saying that, you know, his team have been organizing for this moment. You know, the right has been organizing for a moment like this basically since Goldwater. They're well financed. They're well tuned. They're well oiled. If you look at the what little, you know, we've only saw with one day at the convention, but they're very clear on what their mission are. Right? They're united. They're speaking with one voice. Right? They've done the work to consolidate themselves and are very clear, you know, with their answers about what they're going to do and what they're going to execute. The other side is still trying to figure out, you know, messaging and getting on point. How do we tell people about all the good that Biden's done? If you're trying to do that at this late date, you know, you're in a losing posture, in a losing position. But this whole piece that this system is somehow immune to the things that it had basically enforced on the rest of the world, well, that chicken is coming home to roost right now. And that we best get prepared Trump, and at the very least, the Supreme Court that he installed, which is doing his bidding to restructure society. And we best get prepared for a dictatorship. We best get prepared for them to start hunting, and I mean that literally, hunting various figures on the left. And I want folks to understand that the right has been keeping databases of left activists for many moons now. I'm on several of them, you know, and I monitor some of these things, and some of them, you know, they keep track of these interviews and, where I've traveled, you know, they have their own popular intelligence services outside of what they may have access to if they or when they assume control of the state and its whole monitoring and control, data control apparatus. So we need to get prepared for many of the things that, if you just want to look a little further south, many of the things that our folks in Latin America experienced since the, in the 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, and 80s with the dictatorships, you know, from Guatemala to Brazil to Argentina, you know, to Chile. We can go on and on. All those things, you know, in terms of how they controlled the left or you know, popular forces of resistance and monitored the working class and, you know, kept the peasant forces in basic peonage, if not outright slavery, well into the 20th century and into the 21st. These things are all going to come home and be practiced here in the United States. And then sadly, we are not ready. So the best that I think, you know, realistically we can do is at least sounding the alarm that, hey, the, you know, this is coming down. You need to consider it. You need to get prepared. Because the first thing, you know, like you said, I agree with you about building community. But the first thing is recognizing that you need community, that you need to be organized. And this is where we got to kind of, you know, crack this shell around the American exceptionalism and all the blind spots that it creates that we still haven't done, I think, in fundamental ways. And that's scary to say and admit. You know, for those forces who are listening to this, you know, and there are many people out there doing small projects like, you know, what we're trying to do in Cooperation Jackson. You know, our job is to hunker down and be prepared and be willing to be open when things, you know, make the shift in November to bring more people in and to have dialogue and not condemn them, you know, for not getting with the program ahead of time. You know, that's not going to do us any good. You know, once folks come, we're going to have to embrace them in open arms and let's try to structure our organizing work to be as embracive to allow everybody to come in, utilizing the resources that we have and the resources that we can amass as more people, you know, kind of pull their heads together, pull their resources together so that we can, you know, scale up, you know, through those means. Because that's the first order of what we're going to have to do. And it's the first level of what we're going to be able to control and make use of.
Well, that's a very difficult task, and it shows
we may not have no choice.
But it also shows to the degree that American exceptionalism is embedded in people's psyche, because the reflex is like, I put in work, I've been preparing for a very long time. To hell with you for not preparing. And people have said it arrogantly, not just, you know, not movement folks, just people who have been like, well, you know, we survived these things. And people have said, some people are going to have to go, Collie. Some people are going to have to fall to the wayside.
Oh, yeah, but that may be you. One bad day.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, one bad day or somebody a little bit more hungry than you and got more aggression than you and you run out of luck or you run out of bullets. Because remember, we ain't producing no bullets. So you can store up thousands of them. That don't mean that at the end of the day they're going to protect you. We see this bunker mentality that they promoted to us about how you survive is a backwards orientation and a defeatist orientation, because there's only so much food that you can store before it goes bad. And if folks are really hungry and starving and riding, like you've been seeing, like in all these zombie movies and X, Y, and Z. You know, you and your family are not going to withstand hundreds of people, you know, coming to get what little food you got.
Yeah.
So that is the wrong approach towards dealing with this crisis. That is absolutely the wrong approach towards dealing with this crisis. Right. The more community we build is in trying to ensure that we are collectively meeting each other's needs. That's what's going to give us the greatest protection and keep folks from marauding at the door or, you know, coming to get with what you got or what they think you got or what they think you hoarding. Because when and if we get to a level like that, few will survive, you know, and don't fall into thinking like, you know, you like Elon Musk or some of these, or Bill Gates, some of these folks who are just buying all this land and doing all this hoarding. They're going to be okay. Remember, at the end of the day, they still rely on human beings to meet their needs, right? And the security guards that may be, you know, hunkering their place, if they don't adequately share with them, the table could totally flip. Because, you know, if it really gets rough, paper ain't going to, you know, money ain't going to have much use, right? And that digital currency, all that stuff, the electricity guard, that ain't going to have much use. And then it'll be more even, Steven. And if might makes right, those tables can turn even on the rich very quickly, right? We need, those of us, on the bottom, we need to take a different approach to this. One, which is about, you know, pulling folks in. And what's that line from, for those of you who are science fictioners like me, from The Expanse that the Belters have, the more you share, the more bounty you have. I forget the exact phrasing of it, but it amounts basically to that. That is the orientation that we need to have, right? Point blank.
Ali and Kuno, let me ask you this. I'm going to come back to France and this Move Rightward. And one of the things that stood out is that we heard the name Le Pen and we saw the move to the right, you know, 8-9 years ago. And what I think is sobering is that they're still there. They may not have won all the power, but they're still there and they keep fighting and fighting and coming closer and closer. So that's one thing I want people to kind of bookmark. But the other thing, too, what is driving that? And what I mean by that, anti-blackness and anti-immigrant has been a rallying cry all throughout Europe. It has led to the formation of a lot of these right-wing apparatuses and parties. And I'm thinking about what's going on in the continent with folks pushing back and trying to get rid of the albatross of France around their neck. And I'm wondering if a traditional far-right party that says we're spending too much money in Ukraine and too much money, you know, in the Middle East, does that stop when it comes to exploiting Africa and how they see black folks? In other words, I started off by saying one of the things that I was shocked to see, and I shouldn't have been, was seeing black criminality being a product that is being pushed.
Exported. Yep.
Being exported around the world. And that is not by accident, it's by design. It to me, it kind of plays out in two ways. One, it definitely makes us expandable in the minds of people. It's like, you know, you have folks, even black folks, even like your NAACP, you know, here in Oakland, lock them up, throw them away. You know, people forget that it was black folks that told Joe Biden and black leadership or misleadership that encouraged Joe Biden and them to do the crime bill in 93, 94. That's, you know, right. Just look at, I mean, we can pull out those receipts. A lot of folks is like, if you really support black people, you're going to lock up these crackheads and these crack dealers, right? So you see that playing out right now with folks like, you know, lock up these bippers and, you know, and get rid of Prop 47 and all that. You know, these are black faces calling for that to happen. But with that being said, this constant bombardment of images of black criminality, which is being exported, not only does it put us as black folks here in a bad position, but it may, in my mind, underscore the rhetoric about having immigrants. You know, it's like, yeah, you know, same thing. These people need to go. And how much have you seen that anti-blackness, anti-immigrant, be a real rallying cry for the far right? Or is this
that's a rallying cry for the far right everywhere in one form or another. In one form or another, maybe different populations. So, you know, like in France, it's also anti-Arabness, right? You know, which is very clear in particular about France's colonial history, you know, and its domination of Tunisia, Algeria, Morocco, in particular, you know, Mauritania. But there's a deeper component to this, which is not to erase, you know, the racism that the right employs. But we have to look at the material foundations of why that argument works. And why that argument works is because there's a declining standard of living which is gripping the Western world. And, you know, white working class, you know, men and women who in Europe, in Australia, you know, in the United States, Canada, were sold a narrative and a bag of goods, you know, that kind of was poised as a social contract that your lives will be better than those of your parents and your grandparents, in that, you know, material rewards will benefit from you supporting the colonial structure of the world that was built, you know, in the 17th, 18th, and 19th centuries, and that you continue to support the imperial projects, which keep places like, you know, West Africa under the boot and the heel of France, and most of the world under the heel of the United States, and that we are going to extract both material resources, but also financial wealth, you know, from these countries, from these lands, from the exploited labor of the people, those and utilize it to benefit, you know, Western Europe, Australia, New Zealand, United States, and Canada. That has been fundamentally the deal the last, you know, 70 something years since the end of World War II. But that deal has been breaking down because the capitalist nature has been fractured. You know, the capitalist, the system of accumulation has been fractured as more countries have gotten into the game, you know, from Japan a generation earlier to China, to now the rise of places like Brazil. You know, folks can tout some of the BRICS, you know, and I don't see that as necessarily a left body, to be clear, but at the level of how much of the world's GDP is being absorbed by different countries and how they are accumulating more economic power, you know, still to a degree, that's a zero-sum game, in that, you know, if Brazil gains, that means less the United States can kind of extract and exploit, you know, from them. And so the declining standard of living and the social and psychological impacts on that become fuel for the right everywhere. And the right, you know, it is wedded to capitalism just as much as the neoliberals are. The fascists are capitalists. And so without changing the fundamental rules of the game, they then have to blame somebody, find somebody to blame, you know, for their core constituencies, which is white people, white working class people in particular, at least on a rhetorical level. Now, their actual base are primarily what we would call members of the petty bourgeoisie or the professional classes, who are being, you know, kind of squeezed out of existence and having to work, you know, working class lives, even though they may have a college degree or maybe have once been a lawyer or, you know, a doctor, but now not living the lavish lives that they were promised. And so, you know, they're joining the ranks and using their lives and their skills, talents, and resources to reinforce the right and the right narrative. You know, and you see that everywhere. And so they need convenient targets to blame, folks who they can say, well, you know, all these immigrants coming in from Latin America, you know, they're taking, quote unquote, your job, and they're absorbing resources from you without. That narrative doesn't challenge the capitalist system, because it's like, look, you know, immigrants don't give themselves jobs. They get hired by somebody. And they get hired by somebody because that somebody, that employer wants to super exploit them in their labor, you know, if they pay them at all in many respects, to do what, you know, you may have been able to do, but you cost too much for them to make a profit. So, you know, they don't challenge the logic. They just find easy targets to go at. And we got to remember that you know, the black working class is still a target, right? And that, unfortunately, you know, let's be real, the black petty bourgeoisie has not done kind of its overall, has not in the United States not completed its historical task of what we would call, what I would call nation building, to build sufficient institutions that give more material support and resources and control, more self-determination over the black community, so that it could possess resources and productive capacity in its own hand to then direct its future. It has not done that.
It is Hard Knock Radio, Davey D. We are running out of time on today's show with Kali Nkuno, Cooperation Jackson. We have a lot more to cover, and we will do that on tomorrow's show. So we want you all to lock in. Thank you for supporting us. So tomorrow we'll pick up where we left off with Kali Nkuno.
Hard Knock. Turn the speakers in your car up. Quality program. Turn in for the real talk. Don't stop. EMN at it again. Sandman, Dadaman, Chris Juwan Kim. Yeah. Innovation. Stimulating ill conversation. Anything else you just imitation. Simulation. Step into the zone. The Bay Area zone. Hard Knock. Radio. Let's go. Big shout out to Nita and Davey D. Yeah. Honing down at Hard Knock Radio.
Hard Knock Radio.
Kinda crazy though. Oakland stand up.
Yeah. Stand up.
Ensemble Big Night Wolves.
Yeah. Kansas City.
Yeah. Yeah.
Bellevue. Yeah. Come on.
Check out.
Why every novice think they hard knock when they ain't going all in and ain't paid the cost of the fee? Hating that they made they beats trying to eat till it ain't from the steel gray beef. Say please. Maybe they'll save you a seat at the table with their great bread making. Say some peace to their lovers, our neighbor to please. Hey, there's some shade on your name in the street. Let's go. It ain't David G.
Real Talk Radio. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM in the Portland area and all over the world at kboo.fm.
Welcome to World Ocean Radio. I'm Peter Neal, director of the World Ocean Observatory. How old is water? Where on earth is water found? The answers are inevitably complicated. Let's simplify. Scientists appear to agree that water was not natural to our planet and was introduced some 4.5 billion years ago by planetary collision in space delivered by asteroids and solar wind. Water is located by percentage as follows. Ocean, seas, and bays, 96.54%. Ice caps, glaciers, and permanent snow, 1.74%. Groundwater fresh, 0.67%. Groundwater saline, 0.93%. Soil moisture, 0.001%. Ground ice and permafrost, 0.022%. Lakes fresh, 0.007%. Lakes saline, 0.006%. Atmosphere, 0.001%. Swamp water, 0.0008%. Rivers, 0.002%, and biological water, 0.001%. What is biological water, you might ask? It is the water that exists in all living things, including the human body, comprised 60% by water, about 40 liters, without which we cannot survive. Water is constantly in circulation through the water cycle. Although the residence time, its status in any given location varies. In the atmosphere, for example, 7 to 9 days. In the ocean, 3,000 to 3,500 years. Water in all its dynamic iterations is finite in volume. Its utility is constant, except when it is rendered polluted and while still within the system becomes toxic to life. When we speak of a water crisis, we're observing the negative curve of the cycle. Climate-induced drought, for example, accelerates evaporation in one place with dire consequence. But that water is recycled and redistributed elsewhere where it too is needed and beneficial. We are immersed in water conflict, reduced to water wars for access to wells and groundwater supplies to provide water for our manufacture, our fields, our community, and ourselves. It is when we pollute water with chemicals and emissions, with fracking and indiscriminate industrial use, that we reduce the finite amount, not by volume, but by its essential utility. Fertilizer runoff, point source, and wastewater discharge, and energy-generated emissions that acidify our coastal areas and deep water ocean, These become accelerated and distributed by natural global systems. That changes the pH and kills ocean coral that enters our bodies through consumption of poisoned freshwater. Scientists estimate that today 1 in 4 people on Earth, some 2.2 billion, do not have access to safe drinking water, and that such unsafe water accounts for 1 million deaths per annum. According to a 2020 UN report, roughly half of the world's population experiences severe water scarcity for at least part of the year. Water deficits are linked to a 10% increase in global migration between 1970 and 2000. In lower-income countries, poor water quality is due to low levels of wastewater treatment, whereas in higher-income countries, runoff from agriculture poses the most serious problem. Emerging contaminants and floods and drought persist as the most devastating water-related disasters between 2002 and 2021. The statistics are mind-numbing and seemingly don't pertain to you and me, but they do. We must now test our wells and the condition of our gardens and fields, investigate how the quality and price of imported foods and manufacturing goods might be affected by these conditions, understand how the decline of drinking water and irrigation supplies in India and Mexico and the southwestern United States have repercussions that are real and disruptive to what we consider the natural order of things. Water is old, but there's no new water to replace that which we destroy. What happens if there is no water? As a planet, we would dry out and die. As a community, we would gather and mourn, unless as individuals and nation states we declare a new water ethic, a mandate built around the understanding that confirms water as the universal healer, elementary and essential, not just for personal health and collective welfare, but for survival as the singular, most essential physical, political, and psychological element of our lives, finite and eternal. We will discuss these issues and more in future editions of World Ocean Radio.
You are tuned.